Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do our brothers and sisters have to do with the people we become? While most of us lose our parents long before the end of our lives and meet our spouses and have children long after childhood, Time magazine senior editor Jeffrey Kluger would remind us that our siblings are likely to be around from the time we are very young until the time we are very old. And from the beginning, these people we play with and compete with, taunt and support, love and sometimes hate, have a huge and indelible effect on who we are and how we relate to the world. Jeffrey Kluger writes about all this in his new book, The Sibling Effect: What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You had perhaps a more complicated sibling experience than the average American. You have three full brothers, you have half-siblings, and for a time you had two stepsisters. Have you always been aware of how much you affected one another?
Well, I think the short answer is yes, and the slightly longer answer is that initially this was particularly the case among my three full brothers and me, partly, mostly because we went through so much together. As you say, our background was a little more complicated than a lot of people's, and it involved a lot of turbulence, it involved a lot of domestic unrest. And that means a lot of trauma for kids. And, you know, for us, as is often the case with kids who come from rocky households, particularly in which divorce has been a primary feature, the kids tend to pull together because the sense is that the two anchors of your life, your parents, are not behaving like anchors. They're kind of coming unmoored, and it's then the responsibility, or it sort of falls on the siblings to pull together and fill in that gap themselves.
We often hear that firstborns are the go-getters of the families, and they tend to have a slightly higher IQ than the ones who come later. What accounts for that?
There are a number of things that account for it. In terms of the greater level of ambition, it often has to do with the fact that that firstborns tend to internalize the family values better, simply because they have a little bit more exclusive time in which to have them inculcated into them. Parents also invest more heavily in firstborns by definition. They get a 2 or 1 or 5 year head start, mm-hmm. and as a result, firstborns have total immersion time with parents that other sibs don't get. So they tend to adopt and sort of echo the parents' values more closely. In terms of physical size and IQ, physical size is less the case in the U.S. and in other parts of the developed world than it used to be. But basically that was that firstborns had exclusive access to the family stores of food, or at least didn't have to share it with other kids, and later on they do share it. In terms of IQ, this was a really interesting finding from a 2007 Norwegian study that showed that firstborns have a 3-point IQ advantage over secondborns, who in turn have a 1.5 IQ advantage over thirdborns, and it tends to sort of flatten out after that. And the thinking behind that is twofold. First of all, the oldest sibs get that, as we said, that total immersion advantage, so they simply get more intellectual stimulation for the first couple of years of their lives. And they also benefit from mentoring the second-born and the ones beyond. And as we all know from trying to master a task, there's no better way to learn it fully than to begin teaching it to someone else.
We should remind latter-borns that although 3 points is statistically significant, this is not the difference between, say, Harvard and, you know, barely getting into community college.
Well, that's right. Although, you're absolutely right. It is not, in almost all cases, it's not a significant difference. But one of the folks we interviewed, I believe it was Frank Sulloway, did point out that in some at-the-fringes cases, it does make a difference. And the very example he uses that is that 3 points can translate to about a 15-point difference on SAT scores, mm-hmm. which also isn't big. But if that 15 points is the difference between, say, 685 and 700, it might, in some cases, be just enough to tip you over. And, you know, spread that small but significant phenomenon out over a whole population, and it does go a little bit to explain why we see more firstborns in say the CEO seat in corporations, and there are more firstborns in both the House and the Senate. Senate and other high-profile, high-accomplishment positions like that.
On the other hand, youngest children tend to be the best at reading other people and at charming them. And some of this has to do with the fact that within their families, they have the least amount of power for a very long time.
That's right. And this is called, appropriately enough, a low-power strategy. If you're the smallest, weakest, and youngest in the playroom, you got to develop some other skills pretty fast if you're going to make it out of childhood alive. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to do that is to be able to intuit what's going on in someone else's mind, to be able to pay closer attention. And we see that in a lot of people in our lives. Some people can sit down at a big dinner party and just tell right away if someone across the table from them is upset about something or is fidgety about something. Other people won't even notice it. Youngest borns also tend to be funnier. Well, all of this gives you a certain power to charm and disarm people. One of my favorite skills youngest borns develop defines these other ones. It's called the theory of mind.
Mm-hmm.
If say a toddler is in a playroom with a babysitter, and the babysitter hides a toy and the toddler sees where it's hidden, the toddler will assume that anyone who comes in the room afterwards will also know where the toy is, the thinking being that all knowledge is universal knowledge. When kids get old enough, usually by age 3, that they fully grasp that what's in my mind is different from what's in your mind. That's a very, very big developmental step. And lastborns tend to get there a little bit faster than other sibs do.
So let's talk about middle children. I guess Jan Brady had it very tough, but middle children do take longer sometimes than their siblings to sort of discover their identities, but they also find sources of help outside the family.
That's right. Middleborns don't get the same investment, the same exclusive investment that first and lastborns get. Now, for a short period, they are the lastborn, so they do get a little bit of that, but immediately afterwards, or ultimately afterwards, another child comes along. Well, suddenly you're stuck in a center seat for the entirety of your life, and that can be very difficult. Middleborns do tend to have a somewhat lower level of self-esteem than first and lastborns do. They tend to be a little bit less invested in family and feel a little bit less embraced and protected by family. The upside of that is, and there is an upside later in life, that, as you say, they do become a little bit better at developing relationships outside of the family, at forging new bonds, and at building networks, because simply by need, they have to go out and find this. Again, the difference isn't enormous. It can be subtle, but it's just enough to make a difference in people's frames of mind and worldviews. And finally, keep in mind, birth order rankings are not absolute.
Mm-hmm.
In my family, for example, I'm what's called a functional firstborn. My older brother moved out of the house to go to prep school when he was when I was 12, and you know, he wasn't temperamentally equipped to discharge all the duties of office anyway. He had enough mishigas in the family. So I sort of adopted some of that, and some of that has stayed. You know, mm-hmm. I am now that our mother is 80 years old, I'm the one who keeps an eye on her finances, and I'm the one who, you know, talks to her lawyer or her accountant when that needs to be done, not the oldest born.
How does birth order affect the likelihood that we will be mom's or dad's favorite?
Well, mom's and dad's favorite is a whole different thing. Birth order, one study that I like a lot, and that seems to be one that's oft-cited, said that when one researcher studied families for a stretch of 3 years, visiting them repeatedly, she found that about 70% of fathers and 65% of mothers had an evident firstborn. Now, evident is the key, because parents do a very good job of concealing who their favorites are, particularly if there's a researcher with a notepad there. So you can be pretty sure those numbers are lowballed.
Do we conceal that even from ourselves, do you find?
We tell ourselves that lie a lot. Mm-hmm. Deep in our hearts, parents all know it. But we tell ourselves that lie. We tell the world that lie. I like to say that, 95% of the parents in the world have a favorite. The other 5% are lying. And the only exception to that is my wife and me.
Yeah. And my husband and me.
Exactly, of course. It does... the plurality of favorite pairings in those 65 and 70 groups were the father preferring the youngest daughter and the mother preferring the oldest son.
Hmm. Being a favorite, though, is not necessarily an advantage.
No, it's absolutely not. Favorites, there are a couple of things that work against a favorite. First of all, the resentment of the younger siblings or the other siblings, often it is the younger, but the other siblings can be pretty damaging. And one of the folks I interview in the book said that, yeah, she was, you know, putatively her mother's oldest, but her mother's favorite, but she never really got the goodies from it because she can't. She said, now as an adult, I can't even fully recall any examples of my mother's favoritism, but I do recall the day-to-day abuse I took from my sister, who resented me for that. Favorites also tend to be less well-equipped than other kids to move out into the world and accept limitations, accept criticism, accept growth experiences. They tend to come out of the nest with a greater sense of entitlement and sense of resistance to being corrected or criticized. One of the examples I cite in the book is Death of a Salesman. You know, it's granted it's fiction, but it's a very good example of an eldest son who was his father's favorite and then crashed and burned in the real world. And as he says in the play, he says, "You blew me so full of hot air, I could never stand taking orders from anybody." And a lot of that does, or that is occasionally evident in favorite kids.
So what about only children? People used to feel sorry for them, but in fact they are everybody's favorite. They get all the resources, and it turns out they do quite well for themselves in the real world.
That's right. In the early 20th century, G. Stanley Hall, who was sort of America's Sigmund Freud, famously or infamously said, being an only child is a disease in itself. And while that is a stark and fairly ugly statement, it does in some respects reflect what the popular belief was, that the only child playroom was a bleak and lonely place, that kids are learning narcissism when they should be learning other-directedness, that they're learning selfishness when they should be learning sharing. And there are a whole lot of things that mitigate against that. One of them is that now, even pre-recession, with a rise of dual-income households in the U.S. and the rest of the world, more and more mom and dad are working, which means that kids are in daycare sometimes from infancy. Mm-hmm. My own daughters were both in daycare by the time they were 5 months old because my wife and I were both working. And so they get socialization full-time, total immersion, sometimes 8 hours a day or more, that they wouldn't be getting if they were in the home with just a nanny or a solitary parent. We often lament as well the overscheduling of kids. You know, when they get to grade school, they finish classes at 3 in the afternoon, and suddenly they've got 3 more hours of swimming practice and soccer practice and chess club and everything else. And, you know, that's a legitimate concern. The kids may be getting overscheduled, but in the case of singletons, it also gives them a few more hours of socialization.
Yeah.
And finally, one thing that benefits the only child is that they tend to grow up in a household. They grow up in a household in which they're outnumbered by parents. So their vocabulary, their taste in music, their taste in TV shows, and their sense of humor tend to skew a little higher than kids with multiple siblings.
So they're cooler.
They're cooler. They're definitely cooler, and they're more mature.
Jeffrey Kluger is my guest. He's senior editor and writer for Time magazine. His new book is called The Sibling Effect: What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. We'll resume this conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior editor for Time magazine, Jeffrey Kluger. His new book is called The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So, Jeffrey, how are sibling relationships different depending on whether it's all sisters or all brothers or a mixed-gender family?
Well, one of the things that that I like to confess as a male in an all-male family is that boys really are barbarians that the girls think we are. And when you have a total immersion testosterone atmosphere like that, it can be even worse. Sisters do civilize. But the corollary of that is also that, that brothers do toughen sisters a little bit. So it works both ways for the benefit of both. One study I like to point to involved pairing up a sample group of males and females in college as if they were on a speed date with, you know, just one pair, have them talk for 5 or 10 minutes, and then afterwards they graded one another, rated the conversation. And consistently, the boys who grew up with girls, with sisters, were rated higher by the girls, and the girls who grew up with brothers were rated higher by the boys. And they were... What gave them those higher ratings were just the things you would imagine. The boys tended to be better listeners, which is a highly prized commodity on the dating market, where men never, or reportedly never, listen. Again, myself excluded. The girls tended to have a sort of winking lack of seriousness and a toughness that boys find attractive.
It's interesting that we have these, you know, huge cultural taboos against incest, but we really don't have to teach this to our kids. Boys don't find their sisters attractive, and girls don't find their brothers attractive. Why not?
That's right. And one of the scientists I talked to said, you know, when you think about it, genetically or reproductively, it doesn't make sense. You know, you find somebody who's in your age group, who's from a similar background, who's often quite attractive, who has a similar worldview, you know, purely going by genetics, our brains would say, bingo, I found a partner. Certainly that's all that happens in the animal community, where, you know, members of the same litter can breed all the time. Humans have all manner of obstacles to that. One is something called the MHC, the major histocompatibility complex, that allows us, it's sort of an olfactory phenomenon, and allows us literally by smell to detect people who are too close to us. And when we detect them, we feel kind of turned off by them. It's the same reason sometimes when people go out on a date and kiss somebody and they say, I don't know, there was no chemistry there. Well, there literally is no chemistry, because that person's major histocompatibility complex is a little too similar to yours, which suggests that there could be recessive gene problems. There's also something called the kibbutz effect going on, which, as its name implies, was first discovered in the early years of Israel, when a lot of people lived on kibbutzim, or communal farms, and families that lived on those farms often wanted the kids in the families to marry cross-family, because, you know, it strengthens the kibbutz, and they all know the other families, and they all like and trust one another. And when the kids were little, they may not have had any objection to it, but when they grew up, they found they had absolutely no attraction to the opposite sex person who grew up across the kibbutz, who they've known their whole lives. And the reason is just that very presence, the proximity, suggests to our primal brains, maybe I'm related. And as one of the researchers I talked to said, proximity means related, and related means yuck. And you just turn off to that person.
So, Jeffrey, as the parent of four children in a blended family, I was really interested to read your chapter about step-siblings.
Wow.
How are children affected by the introduction of new siblings when a parent remarries?
Well, first of all, think about two groups of cats from two different alleys, put them in a bedroom and close the door. You're going to hear some hissing. And, you know, whether that happens outwardly or not, it's going to happen. It could happen in these sort of kabuki ways. It could happen in warring over property. It could happen in, you know, walking away from a dinner table because you can't stand the entree because, you know, your family never ate brisket and suddenly it's been introduced. Whatever it is, in little ways, what you're saying is my genes reject your genes. Mm-hmm. Our family resources should not be going to support people who don't share genes with us. Again, that's just primal evolution talking. There's not a whole lot of reasoning going on there. Proximity makes a big difference in the same way the kibbutz effect helps brothers and sisters sort of turn off to one another, or even stepbrothers and sisters, it also acclimates people to one another, and pretty soon you begin to grow accustomed to the presence of the other people. Only when that happens do you really see those seams starting to vanish and the family sort of starting to come together. One threshold, time threshold, is often thought of as about 6 years. If blended families stay together for 6 years, particularly if the children are very young, the bonds among the siblings and step-siblings may be all but indistinguishable. And in some cases, the step-siblings may get along even a little bit better because they were able to sidestep all of that early competition for the blood parents' attention.
And I guess part of the conflict that can happen is that suddenly you have someone who was the oldest is pushed into the middle, and someone who was the baby has cuter, younger competition.
That's right. And, you know, Frank Soloway, the sort of Yoda of birth order studies, said, you know, when you mix birth order into it, people don't even study. Or when you mix intermarriage, rather, blended families into it, people don't even study birth order anymore because it just blows up existing patterns. When my mother briefly remarried for only 15 months, I was bumped from second oldest to third oldest, which means that the girl who came into our family, the oldest girl, was bumped from first oldest to second oldest. Everything got shuffled, and that particularly makes a difference in the first spots and the last spots. If you're busted down from firstborn to secondborn, that's quite a blow. And if you're busted up from lastborn to second to last, you're not the cutest caboose anymore.
Hmm. So I have two wonderful younger sisters, but as a child, I fantasized all the time about having a twin. Talk about how multiple births affect sibling relationships.
Multiple births are sort of the great mystical area of birth order or of sibling relationships. My well-loved half-brother and half-sister are twins, and so I was able to talk to them quite a bit about, you know, what their experience is. Fraternal twins like them do have a very real, very deeply felt, almost mystical connection to each other. And, you know, they really do feel like when the other person is out of town, never mind if they've moved overseas or, God forbid, have died, it's almost like losing a limb. My sister has had those sort of clairvoyant experiences that mothers have in war. You know, something bad has happened to your son. You wake up in the middle of the night, you just know it, and then you get a telegram from the sergeant the next day. Most scientists will say that there isn't anything mystical going on here, that what really happens is human beings are worriers all the time, and we have those feelings of free-floating anxiety all the time. If that feeling of free-floating anxiety is then followed by something bad actually happening, we assign a new purpose to it or a new meaning to it. But that doesn't mean that the connection between fraternal twins is any less real.
Yeah.
Identical twins are even more remarkable because you really do find cases of identical twins who are separated at birth, and they move to different cities, and then once they reconnect, they have an astonishing degree of similarities. You know, they both may be practical jokers. They both might like the same silly joke. One pair I read about both like making goofy noises in elevators. They both might drink the same beer. They might smoke the same cigarettes. There are two guys I've seen in a piece we did at Discover magazine many years ago who were both firemen. They married women with the same name. They went to the same places on vacation. Again, this isn't necessarily or isn't anything mystical. What's going on is they do have identical genetic templates, and your genetic template kind of drives your personality. So if you have a template for conservatism and conformity, you're likely to drink a rather familiar brand of beer, Budweiser, and if you smoke, you're going to smoke Marlboros. If you have an iconoclast, a rebel's personality, if that's your basic wiring, you may drink some microbrew and smoke, you know, long, skinny, brown French cigarettes. You know, you just, all of these little things play out, and they're all driven by your basic genetic hardware.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Amanda in Fort Worth. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, yeah. This is such a great discussion, and I found that a lot of what he's saying is so anecdotally true in my life. My husband does not think his sister is pretty at all, and I think she's beautiful. But my question is, if a couple has a baby that doesn't live very long, and then they have a second another child who is raised as a firstborn because they didn't know their sibling that died, does that change the dynamic at all? as a firstborn?
No, it would not. That firstborn would be very much a firstborn. The only question would become how much the, for lack of a better term, the ghost of the child lingers. So if the parents seem to exhibit a sort of hole in their hearts where the baby was, which would be a perfectly understandable wound to carry for life, if that comes across too much to the child, then there may be some sense that I'm not as special, and this missing person is always perfect, because absent people are always perfect. They can never do anything wrong. So that certainly could diminish that sense of adoration the first a true firstborn generally gets. But in all other respects, in terms of the total amount of time the parents have, in terms of what the responsibilities in the household will be, in terms of the investment the parents make in the child, you know, both in time and money and expectations for the greatness of the family, all of those would be consistent in that case.
What are the pros and cons of particularly cultures where older siblings are expected to carry a lot of the load with regard to taking care of younger ones?
Yeah, the term anthropologists use here is alloparenting, mm-hmm. and lots of members of families can be alloparents, aunts and grandmothers particularly, but, you know, brothers and uncles do it quite a bit. It's a very good thing for siblings to do, and oddly, we live in a culture in which this has been sort of marginalized. Parents really do handle things, and they also bring in a lot of caregivers like nannies and babysitters who take over when they're out. Agrarian cultures tend not to do that historically because everyone has to be in the field, all the parents, all hands on deck in the field, and the oldest kids who can't work in the field are left in charge of the younger ones. In the U.S., we see this, funnily enough, some lingering signs of this just in Hawaii, because that was such an exclusively agrarian area before it was settled, and there are a lot of the native culture persists, and, you know, there's sort of been a lot of cultural cross-pollination, so even the European and Americans who came in and settled the island have adopted some of the native Hawaiian traits.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go once again to the phones, and we'll speak with Artie in Keller. Hi, Artie. Hello, Artie? Okay, we will move on. We'll take another call in a moment. We have an email here from Lori who wants to know if the birth order statistics still matter when first and second-born siblings are just 10 months apart versus several years.
Well, the differences flatten out a little bit, particularly because in terms of the full-time attention. The child who gets only 10 months of his or her parents' exclusive attention is very different from one who gets, you know, 2 years or 3 years or sometimes more. So the differences won't be as acute, but those subtler rules of the house, the subtler or not-so-subtle power lines, you know, the older child still will be bigger. The older child still will get privileges first. The older child still will learn to read 1 year before the younger child and will get his learner's permit 1 year before the younger child. So all of those things, all of those badges of office remain the same. But it's a very good question in terms of the subtler kinds of learning and early life investment. That becomes a little less significant.
It's been fun for me as an adult to discover how much I have in common with my sisters, because as children, we chose sort of deliberately and radically different interests. And I was interested to read about the interpretation that you have in the book for that.
Yeah, well, that is often seen as what that's called in many cases is de-identification. Mm-hmm. You know, if my older brother, and he certainly was not an athlete, and neither was I, but if he had been captain of the football team, and I emulated him, I could then try to be captain of the football team, too, and get, at best, 50% of the attention the family has to give for high school football players. Or I can go off and run for student council president, or even just adopt a different sport and get 100% of the attention for being a basketball star or the president of the student council. Mm-hmm. When kids de-identify like that, in order to sort of fine-tune their niche, as Frank Sulloway says, this can be especially important in cases of risky behavior like drinking and smoking and drug use. And it also can be really important in terms of teen pregnancy. Little sisters whose big sisters get pregnant in school have a significantly higher risk of doing so themselves. But those who don't will often have made the choice quite explicitly. There's sort of a been there, done that quality to a teen mom in the house, and they would rather distinguish themselves as scholars or whatever else they choose to do.
Yeah, I did think the risk-taking behavior was really interesting, and the statistics about pregnancy are higher if the oldest sibling has had this happen, the same with drug use and experimentation. What's going on there? Is it simply that kids naturally emulate those who come before?
Kids naturally emulate those who come before, and also the closer in age they are, and this is a little bit less so with teen pregnancy and more so with other things, substances, the closer in age they are, the greater the risk is. Some of that is just practical, logistical. If I'm 16 and my big brother is 17,
you hang out.
We hang out, mm-hmm. and there's a fairly good chance our circle of friends are going to mix. If he's 17 and I'm 10, I'll get there eventually, but there's not going to be any overlap between our social circles. So if his group has cigarettes, I'm going to get cigarettes. If his group has beer, I'm going to get beer. All my brothers and I smoked at one point in our past, and that happened exactly the same way. My number three and I spent a lot of time in the same circles. I don't even know who had the cigarettes in that circle, but ultimately we both got them.
Is there an issue of it being normalized as well in the family, if this is something that is known to your parents?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that, of course, is what you see in households with all kinds of health challenges, you know, obesity being one of them, or cigarettes, or alcohol, or even drugs. You know, if the parents do it, obviously that becomes validated. If the kids do it and the parents know about it and don't intervene or don't try very hard to intervene, then that's right. It becomes normalized. You see all kinds of risk behaviors, violence in the home as well. You know, kids tend to be more violent in those very, very dangerous homes in which, say, the husband is a batterer, because that just becomes what you know.
Jeffrey Kluger is my guest. He's senior editor and writer for Time magazine. His new book is called The Sibling Effect: What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. We'll talk to more of you after this break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Time magazine writer and senior editor Jeffrey Kluger, whose new book is called The Sibling Effect: What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey, it's almost hard to believe that we've gotten this far into the hour and not yet spoken about sibling conflict. As it turns out, they are not so much fighting about mom's and dad's attention, but about their stuff.
Well, yes, that's right. The overwhelming share of fights, particularly among small kids, involves rights to property. Hmm. And clearly we see that all the time. That's my toy, don't touch that, even if I'm not using it. I refereed one of these very fights this morning between my 8 and 10-year-old, and the 10-year-old picked it up, the 8-year-old wanted it even though she wasn't playing with it. It drives parents to distraction. But it's understandable, particularly in very young kids. They come into a world in which they are the tiniest people in the house. They clearly are the least powerful people in the house. They're dependent on grown-ups for everything. The very first way you're able to project your minimal power is through your possession. Mm-hmm. These things are yours. They're a tiny way of expanding the chalk circle that surrounds you and defines your world. Well, if you've expanded to a few inches away from yourself and someone starts crossing that line, it's going to make you nuts. You've worked hard to acquire those things and acquire a sense of control in your world. So it's not surprising that it's one of the things that kids fight about. Innately, even the trespasser tends to recognize it ultimately. By no means are all battles over property settled amicably, and they're never settled permanently. But when they are settled, in the significant majority of cases, they are settled in the advantage of the person whose property it is. And that's even the case when it's a bigger kid who encroaches on a little kid.
Do families with multiple children tend to have one who is really truculent, one who's the peacemaker? Are those roles sort of assigned to individual people as opposed to shared?
They very much are. Now, you're right, of course, to suggest that they're shared. Not that the truculent person isn't truculent all the time. The peacemaker is going to get into some fights sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this comes from our innate personalities. You see it when babies are born. My two kids were almost different species at birth, given their personalities. But some of that is also just what becomes expected of you. We all live up, down, or laterally toward the expectations that people have of us.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're the truculent one in the family, you're used to that role, and that role is kind of tolerated. If you're the peacemaker, you're familiar and comfortable with that role, and the family kind of starts to lean on you for it. And there's something, you know, that makes you feel good about that. And there's something that gives kids some dignity and some validation when they're called on that way. A lot of this, though, can change depending upon what are called family domains. You know, there's what happens on the soccer field, and there's what happens in the home, and there's what happens at the dinner table and on family trips. And kids do shift their niches around quite a bit depending on circumstances.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Paul in North Richland Hills. Hello, Paul.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. My question is, in my case, I came from a family of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, does this stuff that we're talking about, does it get magnified or is it diluted as you get down the line? Like the middle kids, I think in some ways they kind of got lost, or the ones that were later, like after about six or so, the ones that were from like about 7 to about 13 or so, I think they kind of got a little bit lost. And then my mom, we lost one of our baby sisters, and then, because that was supposed to be the end at number 13 or number 14, and then my parents had two more, and it almost seems as though they started the family all over again with those two youngest ones. And so now the baby of the family, I think, is, I think she's very spoiled.
What do you know about all that, Jeffrey?
Because she got, like, a lot of attention.
Well, that's a very good question, and it is true that you do get to a certain point when the size of families gets big enough, some of the rules do tend to get blown up a little bit. Some of the things about birth order, for example, when there's a minimum of 16 years between the firstborn and the lastborn, there's simply no way that that's going to be a typical sibling relationship, and it will be a lot more like an uncle or aunt relationship, simply because there's such a huge developmental gap between the two kids. Some of the differences in IQ and size and in ultimate earnings, older kids tend to earn a little more than younger kids, all of that gets flattened out as well. It's interesting, and I've never really thought of it quite this way, that you sort of get a clustering, you know, a cluster of firstborns and a cluster of lastborns and a cluster of middle kids. In, you know, the reduced version of that, of course, is a three-child family. And the kids in the middle do tend to be what I think of as, you know, what people call the flyover states. It's easy to pay attention to the oldest and youngest, and people sometimes forget, at least the media forgets about what's going on in the middle. And you see that in the families also. So I think what you see are the same patterns, but written much larger in the case of these very large families.
We have an email here from Melissa who says, I have two daughters. The youngest thinks the oldest is the favorite. The youngest actually tends to get her way often simply because she's more vocal and the squeaky wheel gets the grease. How do I know if I have a favorite? It doesn't feel like I do.
Well, that's a really good and rare thing to be able to say, that it doesn't feel like you do. And you know, I joke about 100% of all parents having favorites. There clearly will be some in the billions of people in the world who truly can't locate that feeling in themselves. And by the way, I wouldn't go looking for it. If you really don't have it, then you know,
let it go.
You're better off than everyone else. But, you know, I do think some of it may also depend on how we define favorite. You know, if there's a child with whom you feel more comfortable, if there's a child with whom you seem more simpatico, if there's a child who seems to be able to read your mind or finish your sentences a little bit more than the other one does, that's often what gets defined as the favorite. I think what may be happening here is a very commendable ability to find all of the good in both of the kids, or in all of the kids, and focus and love particularly those strengths. And, you know, you do that well enough and vigorously enough, and to the extent that a favorite exists, it becomes immaterial.
Jeffrey, have researchers learned to study a group of siblings who are today children and find ways to predict what their relationships will look like when they're adults?
Yes, definitely. And one of the shortcomings, but it's changing in the body of sibling research, is that it hasn't been done terribly extensively or intensively for much more than 15 years. So these longitudinal studies really haven't ripened completely yet. But researchers have done some pretty aggressive studies with kids who are toddlers and then preschoolers, and then they track them, you know, when they get to school, and then they track them again at 6 and 10. And they find that not only do the patterns that get established early remain consistent among the siblings themselves, they also tend to get played out on the playground, which is one of the basic premises of this book, that that what goes on in the family is a dress rehearsal for life. So if kids tend to settle things badly in the playroom, and there tends to be a lot of physical combat in the playroom, those are the kids who tend to have more behavioral issues, more socialization issues, and get in more fights when they get to school. So it's one good reason, one more argument for parents to intervene. They can't intervene in every fight, but they should begin early on looking for broad patterns in their kids' behavior and seeing if some of it is or isn't working.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Looks like we have Artie back on the line from Keller. Hi, Artie.
Hi. I'm sorry. My call dropped the last time.
It's okay. We're glad to have you.
Mr. Kluger, I've read many of your other articles, too, on language and syllables and all those kind of articles. And particularly this one interests me because I'm a middle child. And I come from a different culture altogether. I come from India, and there we have the saying that the first one is dumb and the second one is courageous, which is kind of true because the first one, a lot of fear is put in, whereas the second one is a go-getter. And in my very own family, I see the second ones or even the last ones have been very successful than the first ones. So I don't know, culturally, do those things could matter? Huh. And as far as identifying favorites, I mean, like the previous caller, even I cannot find that because between my two boys, I keep thinking, I mean, do I have a favorite? I still don't know because they both complete us. And maybe there are certain aspects of them that I like in one better than the other, but I don't know if I'm able to pick a favorite.
Yeah.
So that's something I thought I'd share with you.
Well, again, as I said to the previous caller, don't try to pick a favorite. You are blessed if you don't have one. I think you've said something very insightful about how they complete you in different ways. And I think the ideal situation is if everybody in the family is sort of like a puzzle piece and all of the pieces lock and fit together nicely. And it sounds like that's something your family has achieved. Regarding the question of culture, yes, culture makes a huge difference in families. My wife is Mexican. My kids are obviously half Mexican, half Jewish, American. And I see a lot of cultural differences. There's a real intimacy in Mexican families that there isn't in American families. Mexican kids tend to play with one another up to 17 hours a week, which doesn't sound like much, but when you consider all the time and sleeping and homework and school, putting together 17 hours of playtime a week is pretty good. That's 7 hours more than the average European-American family does. So culture makes a very, very big difference in how kids play and how they fit together and what their relationship dynamic is. Also, when you speak about the oldest being the coward, I think you said, one of the things that can drive that is the parents themselves. You know, think about a parent that when your first child reaches 16, he gets behind the wheel of a car and the parents are beside themselves. By the time the second or third child is driving, they're a little bit more calm and they're a little bit more acclimated to it. Well, some of that fear and first child anxiety can get projected to the child, and that creates certain problems.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, oh, we've had a couple survive already, and so
we'll
give this one the keys.
Yeah, we know this drill. We've seen it happen. It was, you know, I even saw it in much smaller days. the first day of school is a little bit more traumatic for the firstborn than it is for the secondborn. Even if the secondborn is crying as much as the firstborn is, I'm simply more acclimated to it. And, you know, I think you see a lot of that going on.
And it's oldest and youngest children who are most likely to take over primary responsibilities for caring for elder parents.
That's right. And one of the reasons is they got the goodies when they were older. Oldest and youngest kids are also the ones who are likeliest to be the favorites. So that's one of the things when we were saying earlier about how middle kids tend to connect better to the outside world. Part of the thing is they didn't get the goodies and they don't feel quite the same responsibility to come back and be there when they're needed later on. That's not to say all middle kids are slackers, but it is to say that first and last tend to take things on a little more. Gender can play a role here too, for better or worse, all families still tend to skew towards gender stereotypes, and often if you have a firstborn son and a secondborn daughter, despite that birth order, that birth sequence, the secondborn daughter will become the caretaker and the firstborn son may simply fall down on that job.
So are there things that we do as parents, deliberately or perhaps unwittingly, that affect the quality of our kids' relationships to one another?
Yeah, one of the things that that makes a big difference is when you do and don't intervene in fights. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a part of a school of thought that says, look, unless the kids are killing each other, you know, let them sort these things out on their own. Well, to a degree, that's true. First of all, because no parent has the time to referee every fight in the playroom. Believe me, I listen, I hear if there's anything crashing or anyone crying, and if it's just an argument, I let a lot of them go. But what some studies have shown is that when parents do intervene, kids learn conflict resolution skills in a somewhat stickier way. One good example is kids, when they're very young, will say, I want this toy. When they get a little older, they're able to say, I want this toy because. Justifying is a very, very big conflict resolution. It helps the other party understand you.
Mm-hmm.
Another big skill is learning to apply present rules to future fights. So you see kids do this all the time on the playground. If they're making up a game and they get to a point they haven't sort of sorted the rules out yet, they'll say, okay, from now on the rule is.
Mm-hmm.
Kids do it on the playground. Once they learn to do that in the playroom, you don't get that same Groundhog Day effect of the same fight being fought over and over again. Studies have shown that when parents do intervene judiciously, they can help kids pick those two skills up earlier.
So you are the second born in your family?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you embody all those traits of a sort of middle child?
I did, particularly growing up. I was definitely the one who was a little more aimless. All of my brothers, we all grew up in a somewhat theatrical, artsy family, so mm-hmm. everybody wanted to be an actor or a singer right away. I did, and then I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I wanted to be a politician, and then I wanted to be an actor. I didn't know what I wanted. I did, as I think I mentioned earlier, sort of adopt the functional firstborn role a little bit, though.
Yeah,
and I'm
sorry to have to jump in. I've asked you this question, and then I've run out of time. Jeffrey Kluger's new book is called The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.